Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Sometimes outside tensions create the energy needed to heal what's hurting inside a relationship. That was the case for Teresa DeFalco and her husband, Anthony. When their marriage started to come apart, a neighborhood troublemaker inadvertently created more good than bad. Melanie Lynskey reads for us this week. You may know her from HBO's Togetherness and CBS's Two and a Half Men. Here she is reading Teresa DeFalco's essay, It Took a Villain to Save Our Marriage.
Here are three truths. Intimacy isn't always sweet. The suburbs can be lonely. And, as the writer Mary Cantwell said, marriages, at least in the beginning, take three people. The third provides the glue. Anthony and I were in year six of our marriage. Not the beginning, but we needed glue. We lived in a suburb, the kind where everyone is friendly, but no one seems to be a friend. Our house was on a short street at the top of a hill. We lived at one end of a cul-de-sac, and a man named Gary lived at the other end, six houses down. Everyone on our street had big, heavy doors. Who knows what happened behind them? What happened behind ours was erosion. There was trouble, but we pretended there wasn't. We didn't talk. As a result, we were angry, and our anger was mounting. We needed an outlet, and we picked Gary, but didn't use his name. We called him Sidewalk Blocker instead, and then just Blocker. He parked his car on the sidewalk. Big deal. But minor drama is the lifeblood of suburbs. He was an opportunity, and Anthony and I seized it. We needed glue desperately that year. The petty details. Blocker had a two-car garage and full driveway, but preferred to park his black SUV across the sidewalk. There were babies on our block, and women who pushed strollers or pulled wagons, and children on bikes. Anyone who wanted to use the sidewalk in front of Gary's house had to walk into the street to get by. The other thing, though, was that Blocker wasn't one of us. He lived among us without children or a wife or an apparent desire for these things. Instead of courting us, he thumbed his nose, driving too fast up the street, refusing to buy candy for Halloween. We, meanwhile, were like an ant colony, reproducing like mad, obliterating foreign objects. That Gary had the audacity to live in our neighborhood was enough to irk some, and besides, it was illegal to park on the sidewalk. We had the law on our side. I walked up and down that hill to the park every day, and as I stepped off the sidewalk in front of Blocker's house, I shook my fist at his windows. One day, I saw a window open and yelled, "Get off the sidewalk!" Shortly after, I was walking with Anthony, and there was Blocker, in his driveway, staring us down. He sneered at Anthony. "I heard what your wife said." He wouldn't look at me. I wasn't surprised. I had already profiled him, deemed him a jerk, and here he was, without charm, never mind the lack of my own. Anthony explained the situation. He can be diplomatic. He told Blocker how we all walked down the hill and that if he would just pull into his driveway a little, we would all appreciate it, thanks. "No," Blocker said, flat but with menace. "I have to park where it's level or my dog can't get out." It was clear he felt contempt for us, that he would fight. He was perfect. Saul Bellow in Herzog wrote that there's joy in indignation, and it's true. The sidewalk became our obsession. Who did this guy think he was? Anthony called the city to complain, and an officer wrote a ticket for Blocker. It was the start of our dance. Blocker's response was prompt. He banged on our door and I answered. He wore faded jeans and a t-shirt, and except for how frightening he looked, like he had killed a man in Reno, he might have passed for attractive. He didn't bother with pleasantries. "If you have a problem," he said, "deal with it to my face." Of course, we already had dealt with it to his face. No matter. He became aggressive fast, shouting expletives at us in broad daylight. Anthony gave it right back to him. I called the police. Just after Blocker left, they arrived and let us relive it all, breathless. My pulse raced as I recounted our exchange. He had directed a special obscenity right at me. My face was red, my blood pumped. From anger, yes, but from excitement too. This was the year I sat across from Anthony on the couch and waved my arms while he watched the baseball game. I would time how long it took him to notice me, but would invariably give up. This was the year the stroller became an extension of my body. The year I became aware I didn't exist. The year I made food and people ate it, mopped the floors and people walked on them, cleaned the toilets and, well, you get it. It's textbook, but Betty Friedan was not required reading for my English degree. I didn't know how awful it would feel. This was the year I felt trapped, like Rapunzel at the top of the hill, lonely and invisible, until a man came to the door, looked me right in the eyes, and called me a name. And Anthony rose up, strong and fierce, to my defense. It went on from here, the three of us in our gloriously crazy affair. There was more yelling and name-calling. When we passed Blocker on the road, he swerved towards us menacingly, and we glared back. When I rode my bike to the gym, I passed Blocker's workplace. Sometimes he was outside and made guttural sounds at me. I knew when he would be outside, just before lunch and near the end of the workday. And these were the times, I admit, I chose to ride by. I then took my stories back to Anthony and we'd trade animated recaps over dinner. We basked in complacency. There were more front yard tirades. When the police ticketed Blocker and he still refused to move, Anthony was furious. He called them again, the tickets piled up, and Blocker marched up our street like clockwork. There is a perverse comfort in it. Anthony and I had something to share again. We were united in battle. We had passion in our lives, if not quite the conventional kind. Some couples take out personal ads and bring home swingers. We provoked the nut down the road. I craved the attention, and Anthony craved the release. It improved things between us, briefly. This went on for months. Then, toward the end of the year, we bought a house in another town. Not because of Blocker, but because when Anthony and I had a problem, we threw life change at it. Our MO. We wondered aloud what Blocker thought when our for sale sign went up. Would he think it was because of him? It didn't occur to us that he might not notice, or worse, not care. We assumed our obsession was mutual. So when the open house signs we had posted around the neighborhood began to disappear, Anthony and I assumed Blocker had taken them. I actually harbored a secret thought that he didn't want us to go. One night during this time, Anthony went silently to bed. We were in the worst kind of fight, the kind you walk away from seething. I fumed and drank too much wine. Then, while the rest of the block kissed goodnight, I stomped down the street in the dark to Blocker's house and pounded on his door. He opened it, shirtless and calm. It unnerved me. I'm sure I looked crazed. I felt my face puff up. "Stop taking our signs," I said. There was a shift. It was he who had the advantage now. I was on his porch and drunk. But Blocker didn't say anything mean. He didn't seem angry, as he should have been, that I had bothered him late at night. He didn't threaten to call the police. We stood close, inches away. There was an intimacy in our strange hate. "I didn't take them," he said. "Seriously, the city picks them up sometimes. I know where they put them. I could check if you want." No, I didn't want. But I thanked him and walked home, both shaken and comforted, and thinking Anthony would kill me if he knew I had crossed enemy lines like that, alone. I didn't tell him. There was one more encounter. Blocker drove by me in his car. He slowed and rolled down his window. And instead of grunting or sneering, he said, "Did you find your signs?" "No, I didn't look." We exchanged a few more words about the weather, his dogs, but it was quick. He drove off, and a few weeks later we moved. Afterward, I heard stories about him. Some were awful. An accident he had caused, taunting a woman on a bike, yelling matches with neighbours, loud parties, police cars. Anthony and I wondered if he ever thought of us. We thought of him frequently. He haunted us. He was such a part of our lives, in fact, that he appears in the novel I'm writing about a marriage in the suburbs. He plays himself. But in the novel, I give us a closure I wish I could have achieved in real life. We share a beer in his driveway, make small talk. I say thank you, but it also means I'm sorry, and Blocker understands both. In real life, though, Anthony and I moved without saying anything. And a year later, just last month, I got a phone call from an old friend, Julie. "I have kind of weird news," she said, and paused. Pauses are never good. "Gary's dead. He hung himself." My heart seemed to stop, and I couldn't breathe. It was impossible. Blocker wouldn't do that. He was Teflon. He was something that couldn't break. He was stronger than all of us. But he wasn't, of course. Not only was he breakable, he was near his breaking point, and maybe it was even obvious. I had just been too caught up in our strange dance to see it. I struggled to sound calm, like Julie, shocked but not shattered. After all, I wasn't supposed to care about him. We were enemies. There were details. I hated all of them. A falling out at his job, fights in bars, a bit of unraveling more so than usual, even for him. Then I remembered his face that first time at our door. How it was dripping with hate and anger, and I thought maybe that was the only thing he could do. It was a violent, profane tirade against all of us. Against life, as it turned out. And it broke my heart.
That's Melanie Linsky, reading Teresa DeFalco's essay, It Took a Villain to Save Our Marriage. Teresa wrote this essay more than 8 years ago. We'll catch up with her after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After this essay was published, Teresa DeFalco was living the dream in Oregon wine country. Two healthy kids, a dog, a beautiful home.
So from the outside, you couldn't have painted a prettier picture. And then on the inside, we just sort of ignored some things. And there were some things that I didn't see at all. And we blew up drastically, so just like our former neighbor did. We just smashed to pieces.
Turns out her husband had an affair with a woman he later married.
And that was shocking to not only me, it was shocking to everyone around us. It was just absolutely shocking. I didn't see that coming at all. And it was just a big, giant hole that it left that we've sort of learned not to fall into, or we walk around. But I don't know that any of us, my daughter, my son, or I, would be able to say that, oh, yeah, when we get over that, that was whenever.
But Teresa's ex is still in her life. She says he stops by occasionally just to catch up and still knows her better than almost anyone else.
You can't just keep saying over and over, he's a jerk, he had an affair, I was there too, I was in the marriage too. And then you have to do a lot of self-examination, which is not fun sometimes, but it's good. You're stronger, much more empathetic. It's just your world becomes bigger. You understand so much more. I mean, in a weird way, I'm glad that it happened. I don't, that's not the ideal way to put it, but I'm glad something happened that knocked me around a little bit, because life becomes real. It's not just an artifice that you're trying to project.
The breakup taught her a lot about the importance of perspective. And those issues that once bothered her, now they're a distant memory.
I think it's funny how petty I was, how petty it was for me to care that some guy parked on the sidewalk. I mean, who cares? My life blew apart. His life blew apart. I mean, he's dead. It just changed my perspective so much after my life, you know, kind of smashed. There's no one's worried about any sidewalks anymore.
Teresa DeFalco is a writer, editor, and ghostwriter in Vancouver, Washington. She's currently finishing her first memoir titled Rerouting. More after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. He says that Teresa's essay explores a kind of passion that's missing from her marriage.
She's so articulate at talking about this glue of this third person who essentially becomes this common enemy. And I always think, what's the opposite of love? It's not hate, it's indifference. And there's a passion in love, which is what's missing in her marriage. And there's a passion in hate, and it sustains her in this odd way, and it sustains their marriage in this odd way. And this guy, what happens to him at the end, is what breaks her heart. She didn't talk about the failings of her marriage as breaking her heart, even though this is not someone she was close to and someone she not only claimed to not care about, but to hate.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for The New York Times. Thanks again to Melanie Linsky for reading this week's essay. Her new film is Little Boxes and is playing in select theaters and on demand. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.